Chapter 67. But in order to ensure the speediest end to the voyage, they all agreed to another thing, namely, not to sing out for whales, in case any should be discovered. For, spite of her leak, and spite of all her other perils, the Town Ho still maintained her mastheads, and her captain was just as willing to lower for a fish that moment, as on the day his craft first struck the cruising ground. And Radney the mate was quite as ready to change his berth for a boat, and with his bandaged mouth seek to gag in death the vital jaw of the whale. But though the lakeman had induced the seamen to adopt this sort of passiveness in their conduct, he kept his own counsel at least till all was over, concerning his own proper and private revenge upon the man who had stung him in the ventricles of his heart. He was in Radney the chief mate's watch, and as if the infatuated man sought to run more than halfway to meet his doom, after the scene at the rigging, he insisted, against the express counsel of the captain, upon resuming the head of his watch at night. Upon this, and one or two other circumstances, Steelkilt systematically built the plan of his revenge. During the night, Radney had an unseamanlike way of sitting on the bulwarks of the quarter deck, and leaning his arm upon the gunwale of the boat which was hoisted up there, a little above the ship's side. In this attitude, it was well known, he sometimes dozed. There was a considerable vacancy between the boat and the ship, and down between this was the sea. Steelkilt calculated his time, and found that his next trick at the helm would come round at 2 o'clock, in the morning of the third day from that in which he had been betrayed. At his leisure, he employed the interval in braiding something very carefully in his watches below. "What are you making there?" said a shipmate. "What do you think? What does it look like?" Like a lanyard for your bag. But it's an odd one, seems to me. Yes, rather oddish, said the lakeman, holding it at arm's length before him, but I think it will answer. Shipmate, I haven't enough twine, have you any? But there was none in the forecastle. Then I must get some from old Rad. And he rose to go aft. You don't mean to go a begging to him? Said a sailor. Why not? Do you think he won't do me a turn, when it's to help himself in the end, shipmate? And going to the mate, he looked at him quietly, and asked him for some twine to mend his hammock. It was given him, neither twine nor lanyard were seen again, but the next night an iron ball, closely netted, partly rolled from the pocket of the lakeman's monkey jacket, as he was tucking the coat into his hammock for a pillow. 24 hours after, his trick at the silent helm nigh to the man who was apt to doze over the grave all was ready dug to the seaman's hand. That fatal hour was then to come, and in the foreordaining soul of Steelkilt, the mate was already stark, and stretched as a corpse, with his forehead crushed inches, but, gentlemen, a fool saved the would-be murderer from the bloody deed he had planned. Yet complete revenge he had, and without being the avenger. For by a mysterious fatality, heaven itself seemed to step in, to take out of his hands into its own the damning thing he would have done. It was just between daybreak and sunrise of the morning of the second day, when they were washing down the decks, that a stupid tenor of man, drawing water in the main chains, all at once shouted out, "There she rolls! There she rolls!" Jesu, what a whale! It was Moby Dick! Moby Dick! Cried Don Sebastian. Saint Dominic! Sir Sailor, but do whales have christenings? Whom call you Moby Dick? A very white, and famous, and most deadly immortal monster, Don. But that would be too long a story. How? How? Cried all the young Spaniards, crowding. Nay, Don's, Don's, nay, nay. I cannot rehearse that now. Let me get more into the air, sirs. The chicha. Cried Don Pedro. Our vigorous friend looks faint. Fill up his empty glass. No need, gentlemen. One moment, and I proceed. Now, gentlemen, so suddenly perceiving the snowy whale within 50 yards of the ship, forgetful of the compact among the crew in the excitement of the moment, the tenor of man had instinctively and involuntarily lifted his voice for the monster, though for some little time past it had been plainly beheld from the three sullen mastheads. All was now a frenzy. The white whale, the white whale! Apostrophe was the cry from captain, mates, and harpooners, who, undeterred by fearful rumors, were all anxious to capture so famous and precious a fish, while the dogged crew eyed askance, and with curses, the appalling beauty of the vast milky mass, that lit up by a horizontal spangling sun, shifted and glistened like a living opal in the blue morning sea. Gentlemen, a strange fatality pervades the whole career of these events, as if verily mapped out before the world itself was charted. The mutineer was the bowsman of the mate, and when fast to a fish, it was his duty to sit next him, while Radney stood up with his lance in the prow, and all inner slackened the line, at the word of command. Moreover, when the four boats were lowered, the mates got the start. And none howled more fiercely with delight than did Steelkilt, as he strained at his oar. After a stiff pull, their harpooner got fast, and, spear in hand, Radney sprang to the bow. He was always a furious man, it seems, in a boat. And now his bandaged cry was, to beach him on the whale's topmost back. Nothing loath, his bowsman hauled him up and up, through a blinding foam that blent two whitenesses together. Till of a sudden the boat struck, as against a sunken ledge, and keeling over, spilled out the standing mate. That instant, as he fell on the whale's slippery back, the boat righted, and was dashed aside by the swell, while Radney was tossed over into the sea, on the other flank of the whale. He struck out through the spray, and, for an instant, was dimly seen through that veil, wildly seeking to remove himself from the eye of Moby Dick. But the whale rushed round in a sudden maelstrom, seized the swimmer between his jaws, and rearing high up with him, plunged headlong again, and went down. Meantime, at the first tap of the boat's bottom, the lakeman had slackened the line, so as to drop astern from the whirlpool. Calmly looking on, he thought his own thoughts. But a sudden, terrific, downward jerking of the boat, quickly brought his knife to the line. He cut it. And the whale was free. But, at some distance, Moby Dick rose again, with some tatters of Radney's red woolen shirt, caught in the teeth, that had destroyed him. All four boats gave chase again, but the whale eluded them, and finally wholly disappeared. In good time, the town O reached her port, a savage, solitary place where no civilized creature resided. There, headed by the lakemen, all but five or six of the foremastmen deliberately deserted among the palms, eventually, as it turned out, seizing a large double war canoe of the savages, and setting sail for some other harbor. The ship's company being reduced to but a handful, the captain called upon the islanders to assist him in the laborious business of heaving down the ship to stop the leak. But to such unresting vigilance over their dangerous allies was this small band of whites necessitated, both by night and by day, and so extreme was the hard work they underwent, that upon the vessel, being ready again for sea, they were in such a weakened condition, that the captain durst not put off with them in so heavy a vessel. After taking counsel with his officers, he anchored the ship as far offshore as possible, loaded and ran out his two cannon from the bows, stacked his muskets on the poop, and warning the islanders not to approach the ship at their peril, took one man with him, and setting the sail of his best whale boat, steered straight before the wind for Tahiti, 500 miles distant, to procure a reinforcement to his crew. On the fourth day of the sail, a large canoe was descried, which seemed to have touched at a low isle of corals. He steered away from it, but the savage craft bore down on him, and soon the voice of Steelkilt hailed him to heave to, or he would run him under water. The captain presented a pistol. With one foot on each prow of the yacht war canoes, the lakeman laughed him to scorn, assuring him that, if the pistol so much as clicked in the lock, he would bury him in bubbles and foam. What do you want of me? Cried the captain. Where are you bound? And for what are you bound? Demanded Steelkilt. No lies. I am bound to Tatadai for more men. Very good. Let me board you a moment, I come in peace. With that he leaped from the canoe, swam to the boat, and climbing the gunwale, stood face to face with the captain. Cross your arms, sir, throw back your head. Now, repeat after me. As soon as Steelkilt leaves me, I swear to beach this boat on yonder island, and remain there 6 days. If I do not, may lightning strike me. A pretty scholar, laughed the lakeman. Adios, senor. And leaping into the sea, he swam back to his comrades. Watching the boat till it was fairly beached, and drawn up to the roots of the coconut trees, Steelkilt made sail again, and in due time arrived at Tahiti, his own place of destination. There, luck befriended him. Two ships were about to sail for France, and were providentially in want of precisely that number of men which the sailor headed. They embarked, and so forever got the start of their former captain, had he been at all minded to work them legal retribution. Some 10 days after the French ships sailed, the whale boat arrived, and the captain was forced to enlist some of the more civilized Tahitians, who had been somewhat used to the sea. Chartering a small native schooner, he returned with them to his vessel, and finding all right there, again resumed his cruisings. Where Steelkilt now is, gentlemen, none know, but upon the island of Nantucket, the widow of Radney still turns to the sea which refuses to give up its dead, still in dreams sees the awful white whale that destroyed him. Are you through? Said Don Sebastian, quietly. I am, Don. Then I entreat you, tell me if to the best of your own convictions, this your story is in substance really true? It is so passing wonderful. Did you get it from an unquestionable source? Bear with me, if I seem to press. Also bear with all of us, Sir Sailor, for we all join in Don Sebastian's suit, cried the company, with exceeding interest. Is there a copy of the Holy Evangelists, in the Golden Inn, gentlemen? Said Don Sebastian, but I know a worthy priest nearby, who will quickly procure one for me. I go for it, but are you well advised? This may grow too serious. Will you be so good, as to bring the priest also, Don? Though there are no auto da fes in Lima now, said one of the company to another, I fear our sailor friend runs risk of the archiepiscopacy. Let us withdraw more out of the moonlight. I see no need of this. Excuse me for running after you, Don Sebastian. But may I also beg, that you will be particular in procuring the largest sized evangelists you can. This is the priest, he brings you the evangelists, said Don Sebastian, gravely, returning with a tall and solemn figure. Let me remove my hat. Now, venerable priest, further into the light, and hold the holy book before me, that I may touch it. So help me heaven, and on my honor the story I have told ye, gentlemen, is in substance and its great items, true. I know it to be true, it happened on this ball, I trod the ship, I knew the crew, I have seen and talked with Steelkilt since the death of Radney. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.